Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. At this time of the day, as usual, is your favorite duo providing you with the best they can get when it comes to putting their hands on the topics to discuss or to share with you wherever you find yourself, whether you are on your way home or you're at work or at your home or at someone else's home. Not judging. Yes, thank you for tuning in.
We are walking a tightrope with that last sentence, but
I know, which is why I had to cut it short.
Yeah.
So as usual, we just have another exciting topic to keep you company here on Eagle FM or here on Home Run. Thank you for tuning in wherever you're tuned in from. Let's talk urbanization, since we are looking at the main discussion taking place, and this is the world over, is the influx of of numbers with regards to rural to urban migration. And rural to urban migration, or just migration in general, this is just something that we are, I find it, as someone that likes history, I find it interesting how a lot of us just look at things like, be it urban to rural migration or just a migration from one country to another, how we find it shocking, like, really? Like, guys, have you read the history of pretty much any civilization? All we did was migrate in search of resources.
Yep.
That's the very, that's the most primitive behavior associated with any animal, not just humans.
And, like that thing that I shared with you specifically about the side projects, YouTube channel, where potentially they've discovered the oldest known urban establishment, like urbanized cluster of humans living together with some form or shape of, how they process, whatever they're doing, from, and primarily, how they make their food and how they, and a religion, because there was also significant signs of religious, participation, or that people actually came together for the religion part, which is actually fascinating, Helmut. This actually proves a point to what we even see here in the modern day Namibia, is that humans love their religion. You know, they will actually move their whole family to go and practice religion or participate in a religious setting, which is obviously part of the Constitution's freedom of association, which also is part of the Constitution's freedom of expression, freedom of choice, all other manner of freedoms associated to that, which is in the basic principles of, well, what's that thing's name? Basic human rights, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, before it became a human right, it was something else, all right? Because, one of the things that I find, interesting, I knew that about ancient Egypt, and I read about it at least on, from ancient Egyptian history and, ancient is either Chinese, Japanese history, just some parts of Asia. And I just came across a documentary of the, of the Rurik dynasty, which is a significant part of Russian history. From the look of things, one thing they have in common is when some guy with high profile, died, they were sent into the afterlife with everything that they are going to need in that life. That means if you were the king's right-hand man and the king is dead, the guys, culture dictates that he's going to need you in the afterlife, so we're going to have to kill you, buddy.
Culture dictates, I am.
At this point, I'm like, poisonous, obviously, to drink, or some were just, literally killed in all manner of ways, and then buried beside, just right next to the prominent guy who died, so that they can save the guy in the afterlife. I'm going, you know what? That may have been very interesting back then, but right now, although, if you brought that tradition back, I know a few people that will want to be buried right next to their preacher. So, just not to mention any names, because the reverence is just on a whole another level.
Yeah.
I respect you as a preacher, but if you die, that's on you. I'm not sitting next to you so that I can be your deacon in the afterlife. No, thank you. But, look, the thing is, people have always, when it comes to migration and religion is one thing that comes up all the time, every time that you can just pick any type of archaeological records.
Mm.
You have a lot of, religion is everywhere, all across culture.
Yeah.
And some significant cultural practices. You have monuments that were built in the name of the higher power.
Mm.
And you can look at this in terms of, one of my favorite pyramids in South America. Yes, what's this? The Temple of the Giant Jaguar. More like the religious site that was built during the time of a gentleman with a very fancy name called Yikin Kankawil.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, all these structures were built in the name of, and if you look at, the engineering that went into these structures, you can just see that, today there's more of a conflict between science and religion. These guys merged science and religion and came up with some amazing feats of engineering. One of the oldest church in the, in Christian history is the Church of Holy Wisdom or Hagia Sophia in Turkey. Now it's a mosque.
Mm.
Yeah. But during the Byzantine Empire, that was, a Catholic or Christian church? It was in a mosque.
It was Orthodox Christian.
Orthodox Christian, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, the engineering that goes into that structure for it to stand for how old is that building now? What, like it's over 100 years?
Yeah.
And it's still standing.
Yep.
Now that actually shows you and the perfect example of that, of just how amazing engineering and basically urbanization around religion and just a religion and also people basically coming together to form what would be the equivalent of urban society today would be your pyramids in Egypt.
Yeah.
For one, to be sure, we don't even know how old the pyramids of Egypt are. We know they are really old. One guy did a timeline explanation that you have to understand that every time we talk about Cleopatra, is it Cleopatra the third or the second? The one that that comes to mind every time that we mention the word Cleopatra. And, some literature says that, Mark Anthony, or is it Mark Anthony Julius Caesar called a woman with a golden mouth? Don't ask. Now, that's my favorite part of history. Now, look, you have to understand.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I love history. And well, that explains why she was basically juggling Mark Anthony and Julius Caesar all at the same time.
You think, it's history, guys.
Hey, it's Gamboroto history. Everything has history in this world.
No, that was a very powerful Gamboroto.
No, Cleopatra, something else.
She was no one's Gamboroto. Let me just know you. She was, and the word queen didn't exist most for the Egyptians back then. It was, that's why a woman can be a pharaoh, a man can be a pharaoh. There was no king and queen situation. There was no.
Yeah, the pharaoh is the very Egyptian title.
Yeah, the word itself.
Yeah.
Didn't have gender connotation like you would say king and queen. Emperor.
Like
empress.
Prince and princess. Yeah. Emperor, empress.
Nothing. It was just pharaoh.
That's it.
Straightforward. And it was another situation. If you married the pharaoh, meaning you became the husband to a pharaoh, she's a woman. We are assuming it's a woman that you're marrying. Anything else? Obviously, that's everyone else's, prescription, what they like. So,
you know what?
So, if you married a pharaoh, a woman pharaoh, you also had to take on her name.
Right.
So, another situation.
From Helmut to Ptolemy. That would be nice. Now, now the interesting part about the Ptolemaic dynasty is, I mean, it's just fascinating when you look at it from, you know, the Ptolemy, the younger brother, the 9-year-old who was now forced by tradition to marry his 16-year-old sister. Jesus Christ. That was just a power hungry to being taken to a whole another level. Mm. But the thing is, urbanization is not something that's new. It's as old as history. Mm. And so is migration. Actually, compared to urbanization, migration is the oldest pattern in human behavior that's being observed as far as, I mean, look, we had to move to find resources. Mm. We had to move to find food. We had to move to find water. We had to move to find anything.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's one of those things that we, you know, that, that gives us a link into, you know, into how similar we are with wild animals. Because, you know, wild animals migrate. They have migration patterns.
Mm.
Birds have migration patterns. And well, human beings are not very different. We also have migration patterns. Back then, it was migration in search of water and food. Now, migration in search of employment.
And temporary shelter as well.
Yeah, and temporary shelter. We had to, well, how do you think we ended up in Southern Africa?
Plus the caves that have, what do they call that thing? Proof of other things, you know, bones.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Present.
Now, when it comes to the oldest towns, more like the oldest evidence of what may have been urban areas. Is it Göbekli Tepe is in Turkey, right?
Yeah, the two tepes are in Turkey.
That's a nice description. They say,
is Karahan?
Yeah, it's Karahan, yeah.
Tepe,
yeah.
The latest one, and the other one is Göbek with the bigger one.
Yeah. Now,
if you guys don't know, you can look it up. The second one that we mentioned, Karahan, is actually an archaeological site right now. They're busy excavating. They don't know how deep or how big it still is. So, which also proves, according to what they carbon dating, is that apparently it's the oldest known urban
settlement
in human history. Here's a list also, Helmut, that I pulled from worldpopulationreview.com. They play with stats and various other data entries. The oldest continuously inhabited places. The oldest is Damascus, 10,000 BC.
Damascus?
Of Syria. Damascus. Syria is taken.
Yeah, you read about Damascus in the Bible.
A lot you read about Damascus. Damascus has been a focal point of culture, of trade, of wars being won, wars being lost. But it has always been continuously populated and has always
been inhabited.
Then there is Jericho, which is considered to be in Palestine, but obviously the Israeli politicians would deny such a situation. Then you have Susa from Susa and Plodiv. Plodiv is in Bulgaria, Susa in Iran. Both are at 7,000 BC. Jericho was at 9,000 BC. And then the rest are at 5,000 and 4,000 years ago. 5,000, 4,000 years. Okay, if you say BC, if you count from now, 2026.
It's understanding you're counting downwards.
From now, that way. You are looking at...
If you're counting from today back in history.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're looking at potentially Damascus being 12,000 years. Jericho being 11. Plodiv and Susa being 9. Because remember, it's 2,000 years this side from Christ's birth.
Yeah.
There's 2,000 this side.
Yeah.
But these guys are mentioning 5,000 BC.
Yeah, so
which
you're
is literally before 5,000 years before Christ.
Holy cow.
Aleppo is also there in Syria. 5,000 BC. First inhabited, 5,000 BC. Mm-hmm. 5,000 BC. We're saying 7,000 years ago, a city known as Aleppo had been inhabited. Athens is also there. Beirut in Lebanon. Byblos in Lebanon. Who's the other one? Fayum in Egypt at 5,200 BC. So just to set the particular scene, the Karahan Tepe is considered to be at 12,000 years old, which, you know, if they actually have to, you know, sort of like adjust the court based upon what this ranking highlights here, we're probably looking at the world's oldest first example of human urbanization that has taken place. And it's actually the crux of our discussion for today, dear listeners, because the UN Habitat, which is the UN agency for housing, technically based, everything based upon housing or around housing and urbanization, they brought out a solutions report. A lovely report that we obviously looked into for today's discussion, because that report actually speaks to everything we've been talking about here on the Home Run up and until yesterday as well. Everything. It technically takes everything together.
Compile it into one
single document.
109-page document.
That aims to answer the questions of financing, of sustainable environmental management while urbanization is taking place. How to upgrade informal areas to actual formal suburbs, which City of Windhoek recently announced, the new suburbs. But for some reason, people were making fanfare of that announcement as if it's going to happen at the drop of a hat, at the snap of my fingers.
Yeah,
you can hold your breath. Let's see if you'll be alive 5 years from now. So, yeah, looking at that particular scenario, urbanization is as old as humanity, technically.
Yep.
Modern humanity. Let's also clarify. Modern humanity. And it also throws a little bit of a spanner into the works in terms of how the thought process. What was the guy's name from Side Projects, the YouTube channel I shared with you? What he explained was it throws the concept or the belief that how, you know, the agricultural migration also took place. In a scenario of it was first hunter-gatherers moving everywhere, like we, you know, alluded to at the start of the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point,
we figured out agriculture.
We figured out what plants are edible,
mm-hmm.
or which plants are edible. And from this particular...
The hassle we had to go through.
And from this particular point, we decided to just settle down and watch the plants grow, basically. So that because we have sustainable or... you know, a predictable source of sustenance coming through every particular
season.
That's now harvesting season. So, according to that indication, because it seems like, you know, the time periods are a bit warped. Now, Helmut, I know, because I've had a few discussions also with colleagues here at the office. There's a great chasm, I call it a chasm and a schism, which you can probably also call a mountain range in some cases, between, you know, you remember the reference that you made to some people that you, that, you know, might want to be buried with their preachers, favorite preachers and pastors.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chasm in understanding specifically about how the natural world works versus what people have read. For example, like historical documents like the Bible.
Mm.
Now, in many scenarios, a lot of humanity relies on the accounts of the Bible to give them reference to a time period. Now, the weirdest scenario is sometimes when you hear people like that, they will come and describe to you things like how to treat your wife. You know, for example, like what happened to Lot's wife, you know, the woman that became a salt pillar.
When she
literally, I think it was the city of Jericho, when she literally turned around to look at the supposed smiting that the Almighty was delivering upon the city of Jericho, because what was referenced was apparently that there was like rampant debauchery and lawlessness going on in the city of Jericho.
Yeah.
And you have to ask the question, through whose perspective is rampant debauchery and restlessness and lawlessness?
Look, man, when it comes to the story of Jericho, that story, every time I read that story, it makes me love women even more. Because Lot's wife was the biggest contributor to Capernaum today. Without her, I don't think anyone would enjoy Capernaum. She took one for the team. Anyway, you were saying?
Okay, firstly, what people must identify first is what happened to Lot's wife is literally witchcraft. What person have you ever heard turns into a salt pillar by looking at the destruction of a city, of what is happening? Have you ever heard of such an experiment ever take place? And we're not talking about Resident Evil situations or video game illustrations.
Divine power. And then she ended up in seawater and then, you know, somewhere in the mountain range of Himalaya, somewhere in Pakistan. And, you know,
and all
now we are exporting her to Nigeria. You see, about 2,000 years later, she's still contributing to our economy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love that woman.
But you do know how salt is made, ne? There's an on-land, there's an onshore production, and there's a production dependent upon seawater.
Yeah, I know. Like Celtic salt. Is it Celtic salt is one that is recommended by a lot of health enthusiasts. That is the most healthy one. Salt. Look, I just want my food to taste.
But anyway, as long as it's iodated. Yeah,
I know. And then there's Himalayan pink salt, which is basically coming from, because it's, I think they call it Himalayan pink salt because the mountains is taken from, is part of the, Himalayan mountain range, I believe.
Mm.
But most of it is coming out of Pakistan. And then I buy it all the time. Just looked at one of the labels indicating that, you know, it's packaged, you know, Shakati. I'm like, right. We are doing some awesome work here. Himalayan pink salt all the way from halfway across the planet and it's been packaged here. Congratulations, Namibia. But, human civilization have always come together. And I think that stems from one important, also very basic nature of human beings.
Mm.
We are not solitary creatures. We are social creatures. So we will always come together.
We'll
always come together. And the more we come together, the bigger that community becomes. So that puts a lot of pressure on the leadership to make sure, okay, now how do you maintain order? How do you provide all the services? Mm. So that means you have to constantly come up with a structure on how to provide, social services, water, power, food, and all those things. And in the event of a disaster, how do you respond to it? How do you solve dispute? Obviously, the larger the group you're going to come up with, the more complicated the structure that you will need to figure out to make sure that there is there's order in that community. Otherwise, everything is going to descend into anarchy.
Have you ever read about the history of where police, law enforcement agencies came from? And it was literally an issue, Hamid, because the societies became so big, urban societies primarily.
Mm-hmm.
The army was not an issue, was not the solution, using the army.
An army in terms of policing, that would always be a bad idea.
And even though the French probably have like the most well-documented example of what an actual policing force must be, the gendarmerie is their name, or they call them the gendarmes. The gendarmerie... It's a little bit weird. It's not like how you would think about police.
Mm-hmm.
It's like police / a thug agency. If you see them, it's you. You hope that all the angels are lining up behind you, not just your guardian angel, to ensure that you actually, your human rights is actually, you know, protected mm-hmm. to great length.
Yeah.
Now, the Japanese at one stage also had to develop a policing agency for urban settlements. This is obviously in sort of like the last shogunate of the Tokugawa shogunate that happened just before the opening up to the Westerners, which also saw a rapid industrialization that Japan experienced. And they had to introduce a body known as is it Shinsengumi? No, Shinsengumi is something else. Yeah, it's the Shinsengumi. Which literally translates to like a law enforcement engagement. No, Shinsen Kumi is something else. It's a completely, I'm now making up something here. Shinsen Kumi is literally like a deity, but it was an actual police that they had to bring in because samurais were becoming a problem. There was the saying helmet that they had because samurais carried their swords in urban settings.
Yeah.
So samurai's helmet would walk around, and when they get a little bit tipsy and a little bit drunk and they have a little bit of too much of the rice wine, the sake, they had this saying, which was coded language of saying, maybe I should test my sword on someone. Now, I'm not talking about the one that needs the condom. I'm talking about the one that has the actual blade.
You really are catching up.
So, what happened was the shogunate at the time had to respond by ensuring that that civilian welfare and safety and security. I am right. It was Shinsen Gumi. They were a special police of swordsmen that was organized by the Tokugawa shogunate in 1863, and they had to literally install law and order. And literally, in some cases, they were known as a secret police. In the other case, they were also known as elite group of swordsmen that literally had to, that was organized by ordinary people and low-ranking samurai. And they were all commissioned because they needed to provide the law and order that the modern society at the time in the 1800s in Japan was starting to demand. Now, it brings us, obviously, to also the discussion we've got that we're looking at today. Now, Helmut, a city is not you come in with one approach and you hope to solve a whole bunch of issues with just one approach.
Yeah.
This particular sort of like solutions report, okay, it's not actually a report, it's actually... it's similar to that other UN report, the one about the about having a sustainable tourism sector or industry. Remember the one from the World Tourism, the UN's World Tourism Organization, where they literally said this is the template you need to follow, which is technically based upon Namibia in great length, but this template helps you to extract the maximum value contribution that you want to ensure your economy enjoys.
Yeah, out of your tourism industry.
Out of your tourism. Now, this is technically what this thing also speaks to. If you want to achieve rapid urbanization, rural to urban migration, slum and informal settlement development, you want to upgrade existing informal settlements and slums into fully functional neighborhoods and all that, you've got to look at it from a multi-dimensional or multiple angles in order to achieve a common goal. To achieve one goal. Just
it
one goal.
Be a common goal. In this case, if you are policing, it's a safety goal.
Yeah. And it ranges deallessness from financing to basically aspects of ensuring that there's continuous development, but that there's continuous activity primarily in ensuring they've got, for example, aspects of housing and land, which has been the biggest, I think, like the most over explored subject matter, because we've had people here on Eagle FM that come and talk about housing and land, but they don't specify a housing need. They go and talk about a land need, Helmut, which speaks to a rural need. And in many cases, the need is an urban need and not a rural need. Then you've got how to, sort of like improve existing informal settlements. Urban basic services is another particular point. Another one that they also bring up is equitable. They call it equitable inclusive prosperity for poverty eradication. Sometimes when people use like these long words,
equitable inclusive.
Yeah, they're like, let's just throw a bunch of phrases together, which just repeats. let's, for example, say urban basic services. That's what it basically, you know, emulates.
The word they keep leaving out, that also was just brought to my attention by the lady who did the presentation on, the lady who did the presentation on the part of Industrial Revolution that we, that is not taught. Like, that's because, I think our, you know, I believe, look, I totally understand, the human species have a very long history. We can't study it all. Like, it's, first of all, we have lost a significant part of it. But every time that...
And we keep adding more.
Yeah, we keep adding more every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately, those ones that are going to come
after,
you know, after us are going to have to read about Donald Trump. Huh, poor kids. Now, after...
Does this guy really exist?
Feel pity for those kids already? Jeez.
Yeah, okay. We're still
doing it. Anyway, but whenever we pick a topic, we don't look at it from from all three steps that you should be looking at a historical subject, for example, like what happened before, and then what leading to that specific event, which would be a focal point, and what happened after that, because the Industrial Revolution is often looked at as this. Golden age of, of science, where a lot of scientific breakthrough came, especially in terms of machinery, making a lot of work easy for mankind.
Yeah.
Except it wasn't.
Until you look at labor relations.
Until you look at the history of labor law, then you realize that those laws are a result of a reaction of people who lived during that time.
Of severe exploitation.
Severe is an understatement due to the lack of a better word, because there was severe, maltreatment of workers.
Maltreatment, malpractice.
Their working conditions were terrible.
No, Helmut, please enlighten our listeners. Please go on. Tell what they did. Tell who was the youngest employment cadre. In labor relations.
There was an employer somewhere in the Industrial Revolution who thought that a five-year-old was a worker. And they made workers out of five-year-olds.
Mm.
And in case you didn't know where the whole idea of having an age limit in terms of how young a person you can employ is, that law did not just pop out of the blue. Out of the Industrial Revolution, as we shifted a society from an agrarian society to an industrial one, where we are now talking about skills-based economy, skills-based practice or means of earning a living, away from an agrarian, which also required skills, but this was a whole new paradigm that they were shifting into.
Yeah.
Because this one was about machinery. They're basically processing stuff on a massive scale.
Yep.
For large commercial activities. Now, because of that, a lot of people that were running these industries now, they figured, they have just hit a jackpot on new ways to make money. And they were so focused on making money, They didn't care how many people were caught in a crossfire of them, of all the money that they were making. They were, and this, open pit mining is a fundamentally new concept in the, in the mining industry. For a very long time, it was mine shafts.
Yep.
And mine shafts are very small, confined spaces. That means you needed people with small stature. Thank God I was born right now. You needed people with, thank God I'm born in, believe me, well, I would fit in that thing like much easily. But the thing is, a lot of people now decided to get themselves 5 years.
Helmut. But yeah.
Thank heavens. So they needed people's small stature. This is where kids now came along, because they could fit in these mine shafts with ease.
Mm.
But the thing is, these were like sometimes hundreds of meters underground, and there was not enough air circulation. That means you were breathing in all the dust of whatever it is that was being mined under there.
The dust. The what's that thing from coal mining? Black lung? Sediment. It's because it's not, sediment is slightly thicker than dust.
Yeah.
and black lung is most caused by breathing in literally coal sediment. You are inhaling it. Even though they give coal miners a mask.
Yeah. It's not enough.
If you look at the documentaries about, for example, like the coal mining that took place in West Australia, West United States, the coal mining areas that have now the redundant mining populations,
mm-hmm.
meaning they were all laid off because the anti-mining laws specifically about
began to pick up
like under Biden. So, and not just Biden, but actually a lot earlier.
Yeah.
Because America was moving greatly towards nuclear power reactors, which is also a very...
That's interesting.
Helmut, they've got so many nuclear power reactors that are run by corporate companies. By like, not SOEs, corporate companies.
Private companies.
Yeah. Which is very weird because, for example, much of the discussion about like developing civilian nuclear energy capabilities here, like in the developing world or the developing nations, the global south, is that we have to go ask permissions. But if you go look at the developed countries that don't have uranium, they can't mine uranium.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Germany doesn't have uranium. France doesn't have uranium mines in France.
Mm-hmm.
But in Europe, they had the highest concentration of nuclear reactors.
Nuclear power plants.
It was only Russia that was mining uranium.
Yeah, well, they have it.
Because they have it.
Yeah.
United States has uranium mines.
Yeah.
Canada is also one of the world's biggest uranium miners. Australia is the other one. Then comes us. Then comes Burkina Faso. There's another African country also. Mali is also there.
I think Nigeria is on that list.
No, Niger.
Nigeria.
Nigeria's not there, but Niger is there. So, all these, but if the guys that I'm mentioning, like the last batch, the African countries, but we're not the ones that have nuclear reactors.
Look, the thing is, if you're talking about the reason why a lot of developed countries are very touchy about seeing a developing country trying to explore its, uranium usage.
Yeah.
It's that's mostly based on two points that I can think of. One is a very genuine concern, which if you look at some of the leaders, chances of them, if you just leave them unregulated, especially by the International Atomic Energy Agency, they'll start building all kinds of weapons.
Mm.
So that's a genuine concern. The second one, I think that concern builds up to the next one of a lot of countries, especially like the US. They're very paranoid about that.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, they're very paranoid about that, and
they've made their paranoia very public.
Very public.
They're not worried about Japan. They're not worried about Russia. They're not worried about China. They're not worried about Russia. They're not even worried about North Korea.
But these are the guys that they're in competition with.
And those guys already have their nuclear warheads.
India
already has its nuclear warheads.
Look, the paranoia is not helping because
Pakistan, which doesn't mine uranium, has nuclear warheads.
And the situation that Pakistan was involved, that had to go through to acquire their nukes, is somewhat the same that Iran is going through right now.
No, but Pakistan was given their nukes by Nixon. Pakistan was given their nukes by Nixon.
Yeah, but to perfect it, I think they perfected it in the 90s, and it was very contagious. It was a very tense situation that they had to go through, especially with the Israelis. And the thing is, the Americans helped Iran. The Americans and the Israelis helped Iran basically lay the foundation of their nuclear program.
Mm.
Now it's not. Well, now it's weapons of mass destruction. And, what's this? Basically, they helped South Africa acquire them.
Yeah.
So I think what they don't look at is that politics is very fragile in a way. Things can change overnight depending on the foreign policy ideas of the person that's occupying the executive office.
Yeah.
What's the easiest example to use? Iran is another example, because if you go to, you know, when the Shah was in office, they had all these whole nuclear programs going on. Fast forward to 1979 after the Iranian Revolution. That's when they realized, oh my God, okay, we have given these guys a nuclear program. Only now the guy that's in office is, you know, doesn't like us. So that means that program is now his program. Mm. And then they started, you know, just going bananas and started, you know, being, you know, running for their life for something that they helped design. Like, that's really one dumb thing that I see about geopolitics. But, you know, for energy uses, there are a lot of countries that would like to use nuclear energy. Nuclear material strictly for energy.
Yeah.
But because of the unpredictability of it, it's very difficult to tell who has genuine need for energy use of uranium and who could use it for weapons purposes.
Yeah.
You can take Namibia, for example. We are exploring that, and we have a lot of it. Actually, it will be a lifesaver in terms of energy. And energy and road infrastructure you need energy. Energy is the foundation of anything industrialization. And because of that, of that paranoia, it's now, you know, we now have to jump through all these hoops to come up with one. And the fear is not just outside the country, it's also inside the country. I can write a list of politicians I would not trust with a nuclear program just here in Namibia.
Yeah, let's not mention names.
No, no, I won't, because I don't
have a lot. I think I know who you might.
I have a list. I mean, you can just look at it. This guy with a nuclear program. Oh, he's building a kaboom, that's for sure. And what's worse is that I wouldn't just blame the politician if you ended up with a politician in office that decided to go with to explore weapons capabilities or more like weapons usage of nuclear of uranium, but because geopolitical wise, that's the picture that's been set, that if you have nuclear weapons, no one touches you.
Yeah,
like with what's going on in Iran. And the constant comparison between Iraq, Libya, Ukraine, the constant comparison with these countries that I just pointed out, with North Korea, believe me, every country have never wanted nuclear weapons than they do today.
Yeah.
Everyone knows North Korea has nuclear weapons. No one is going to touch North Korea because they have the weapons.
Mm.
The reason why Iran is under constant bombardment is because they don't have them. If they had them, like, that's the unintended consequences of this, like, of a paranoid of, everyone having a nuclear program.
Yeah.
Now, it has sort of like led to the opposite of what they wanted. The goal was to nuclear non-proliferation. Now we are going to end up with a nuclear proliferation. Because, well, every country is now going, you know what? If you look at North Korea, if you don't want the big guys to play with you, just have nukes.
Just for the sake, just for the fun of it.
Yeah, just have nukes.
Doesn't matter how hungry your population goes.
Have nukes.
Have the nukes, have the intercontinental missile, ballistic missile technology.
Yeah.
Constantly prove that the things can launch.
Yeah. And the best place they've been tested is in the desert, and we have two of those.
I don't know why you're happy, Hamoud, about the two of the desert statement.
We're just sandwiched to them, so we can just go around.
They're both protected areas.
No, that's okay. We'll just be testing them in protected areas. That's the dumb part about nuclear programs, because you have to test them. Who is going to live at a place that you're constantly bombing with nukes? No one. And obviously there are fallouts that comes with that. And, well, the whole idea of the countries that have them, they know they are not going to use them.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they know that once they use them, yeah, it's over. like the stupid thing about nuclear weapons is that you can't use nuclear weapons to defend your country.
Nope.
Because at the end of that war, you are not going to have a country.
Nope. Even just thinking about still surviving. The weirdest thing is that the
you're looking at the Hunger Games.
The weirdest thing is that the world climate will kill you after that.
Yeah.
Because the radiation will be transported by the what do they call the thing? By the winds.
Yeah.
By the global wind systems. And if you think you are safe somewhere,
no, you're not.
You are lying to yourself. That radiation will reach you, and that radiation will permeate all across the world. It'll kill most of the existing life. It'll give rise to probably new life, new aliens, a new humanoid form.
Yeah, with five legs. Look, the thing is, radiation is no joke. If you have seen Chernobyl.
Where did the five come from, Helmut?
That will solve the gender problem. Everyone like, so, are you a guy? Are you a woman? Like, yeah, well, thanks to the radiation.
How did we also get there, Helmut?
This is just my mind going wild.
you probably played a bit too much Fallout. Né?
Yeah, that's true. An unhealthy amount, actually. Now, look. The thing is, nuclear weapons are just expensive toys that no one who understands the impact is going to use.
Mm.
That's the reason why the Cold War was called. Because both the Soviets and the Americans knew that if you launch one and then there's a response, first of all, the blast itself is going to kill so many people.
Yeah.
That's just the blast. And if you think, you know what, I survived the blast, you know, I'm good. No, you are nowhere near good. Well, the wind carries all the radiation. That impacts your rain. You know what that means? Terrible agricultural output. In the middle of the time when we are dealing with climate change, that's worse. That means hunger through the roof.
Mm.
Oh, you didn't solve a problem. Mm. Even if you start, going through the, you know, nonsense like, I think that's also the dumbest part of billionaires with bankers. Like, really? Bankers have ventilation systems, you idiot. And now what are you going to do?
That's why I started laughing.
You would think that these people would think of this. Even if you found yourself in a bunker, what do you think the people that are running around, you know, playing real-life, real-time Hunger Games, what do you think they're going to do when they find that, there's a bunker here, and here is a ventilation system?
Oh, they are realizing that, what's the thing's name, that Fallout, is something that they're imagining by these countries arguing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But the weirdest thing that they, of their perspective, mm-hmm. is their involvement in foreign policy.
Yeah.
They are behind some of the foreign policy decisions we are seeing.
Which could lead to them needing their bankers.
Yes. Which could lead to a discussion of them trying to identify, why are we developing AI in the first place?
Look, that's not the dumbest part about bankers, Dwight. Some of the guys that own bankers are in the US. The banker is in New Zealand. Now, like, you can't be that stupid. Now, you have to understand. First of all.
That is stupid.
That's beyond stupid.
That's idiotic even.
Your banker is in New Zealand. You know what? If anything happens, I'll just get in my private jet.
And fly there.
First of all, you have a pilot that has a family. You have bodyguards who has a family.
Yeah, who have families, yeah.
When money is not is not that important anymore, which is why he's flying around and protecting you. Do you think he's just gonna leave his family around, to die because of nuclear fallout on the problems that you caused so he can fly you to safety? Those, ladies and gentlemen, are the thoughts of the people that are influencing your policies.
Yeah.
Like, the stupidity is beyond comprehension on this subject.
Which also helps to serve, Helmut, because on that particular note, that point that you just highlighted there, and everything we've said so far up until right now on the show, it actually answers a particular question in terms of then why are we pursuing an AI agenda in Namibia?
We want to do things fast, you know. Look, we are not even pursuing AI in terms of, in terms of research and development. We are pursuing AI in terms of usage.
Just being part of the AI trend.
Yeah.
Which is one of the biggest things in many cases why this is such an infuriating point, discussion, template to have in the modern Namibia. There are literally people right outside Windhoek who don't use AI, who probably don't have access to stable internet supply. But we are battling towards a platform, a discussion of saying we wanted just to have this, just to say the sake, just for the sake of saying we have the thing.
You know what's my favorite irony when it comes to that?
Yeah.
AI's biggest threat is taking over jobs. We have an unemployment problem, but we want to adopt AI and also at the same time create employment. We have got to be geniuses.
No, we are masterful.
We are Albert Einstein.
Our economic policy making is on. Who's greater than Einstein?
Isaac Newton.
Okay, yeah, he founded much of the laws of physics.
Isaac Newton just,
We want to be like Galileo.
Oh, Galileo.
Someone who changed the way we think. Galileo, remember, went up against the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
He was excommunicated for saying, hello guys.
Guys.
The earth is round,
man. It's actually round.
The earth is round.
Uh-huh.
What justification do you have? Well, there was this Greek guy back then who lived in Alexandria, who also proved the earth is round. And technically, that potentially proved that earth is not the center of the universe, but actually that the sun is potentially the center of the universe.
Actually, that would be the center of our solar system. Yeah. The universe is much bigger, and it's round, by the way, not flat. And the church was like, before then, he spreads that idea, before he spreads science.
Say, get that Satan out of here right now. He's a Satan. And that was Galileo. Galileo, that was the guy's name, if you guys don't know it.
Galileo.
That was his name.
I think his parents ran out of names.
It was an Italian. Back then, names were a commodity as well, if you did not know. So, yeah. Because we have to ask that question, Helmut. If the Danes and the Swedes and the Finns are going like, nah, man, stop giving kids tablets.
Electronics at school.
Yeah. Let them read books.
Yeah.
Let them have conversations with each other, because technology also proliferates antisocial behavior. People don't know how to talk. Helmut, I'm not lying to you. Try talking to a woman who is easy to text you on the phone. Try to talk to her in person. You'll get the shyest person for no reason.
Man.
And then you're like, wasn't this person just now sending memes and all manner of other, I almost said paraphernalia, but paraphernalia are technically like promotional content, which then would have taken that conversation into a completely different direction.
Dude, everyone that has been, which is like basically about 90 to 80% of modern, wall of modern youth, they will tell you, online. Boy, do we have courage online.
There was a teacher I had that says, so you guys will talk the world's crap out there, but the moment I give you a, what was that thing we used to do in school?
The presentation.
No, not the presentation, but it had another name. What was that presentation's name?
What's that?
It had another name, man.
Like storytelling or something?
It wasn't presentation. The actual word wasn't presenting. But when we were told to come and stand in the class and then, let's go for presentation. But present, because it's most early exercises of speaking in public.
Yeah, like public speaking.
Public speaking.
Yeah.
Come and present your story here in front. Then the people clam up. They don't want to say a word of anything.
And then the teacher is like, I know who you guys are. I know you guys. And then she points, and then she pointed at the, at all the girls sitting in the front. It's most of you ladies. They would be talking the biggest crap outside there. But the moment those girls would come into the class, they're like the sweetest angels. They forget even to answer. They're like, yes, ma'am. No, ma'am.
Do you understand? Yes. That's one thing that my science teacher hated. They're like, I don't understand you guys. After every lesson, I ask you, do you understand? Everyone goes, yes. I give you a test and then you get zero. My question is, do you understand when I say, do you understand?
Because what was that one thing? Who did I say? I think it was to my sister where she asked me, do you hear me, Dwight? I said, there's a difference between hearing, which I am doing, mm-hmm. and actually listening to you, which is also a matter of opinion.
He's up for debate. Look, man, human behavior is awesome to observe.
Oh, yeah.
The more, you know, the larger the number becomes, yeah. the more complicated we get.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that means the more complicated structures that you need to maintain order. And people don't understand why we have all kinds of libraries and all kinds of books of law. That's because every piece of literature when it comes to the law that you read can be traced to a story that brought about that piece of literature.
Yeah.
Yep.
Law is full of history, guys.
Oh,
if you didn't know this.
Yeah.
It's fine to know all the laws.
Yeah.
But you must go and learn the case studies.
Case law is amazing. You hear some of the most ridiculous things.
The best one I still have is the one about that brought about, that thing that you find in your products, the expiration date?
Yeah.
Né? Which was a case law that happened in South Africa. Obviously applicable in Namibia. But the court reached a decision in 1921, mm-hmm. which has industrial application up until 2026 today. 100 years ago, Helmut, a court went and said, just because you are the shopkeeper and the owner of a shop does not absolve you of any responsibility and liability mm-hmm. to ensure that the products you are selling, which is in a can, is still fit for human consumption. Because what had happened? The customer had bought a can of baked beans in tomato sauce,
mm-hmm.
but back then there was no expiration date.
Yeah, just to manufacture it and then
put it on the
wish
shelf.
Them luck.
Yeah, and go with God with how you how you consume that stuff. So there was no expiration date indication. And what happened was, unfortunately, one day this one customer bought technically a can of baked beans and tomato sauce that had already expired. Because no one knew for how long the can has been on the shelf or had been in storage. So obviously the customer, suffered a fateful encounter of food poisoning.
Yeah.
As we know, food poisoning might sound like a slight chuckle, a slight laugh in terms of the suffering that some of us have experienced with food poisoning. Sometimes it's self-induced. I do not recommend that scenario, Helmut.
Yeah, don't.
But when it's caused by someone else's, perceived expertise in whatever they are selling to you, it's even worse. So this customer in South Africa took the shopkeeper, the shop owner, to court. The court back then, yes, it's a court. It's a case from 1921. Literally said, you, as the shopkeeper, you cannot run away from your responsibility because you are the last connection between society and the producer of the product.
Yeah.
It is also your responsibility to make sure that what you are selling, because you already received the money from the customer, what you are selling has to be fit for consumption at the moment of the sale of the item.
That means you have to constantly monitor the expiry dates of what is it that you are selling to make sure you're not poisoning the general public.
Exactly. What has it led to, Helmut? It has led to that expiration date indicator and now the manufacturing date indicator, because now you need to know when the thing was manufactured
mm-hmm.
and when its expiration date appears. Now you also find a system, if you've ever seen it happen in the shop, Helmut, The shops now have to do stock taking to understand the actual levels of the stock in the business. Because stock, it's not just about the stock exchange that you find out there in a literal exchange platform, but stock is literally that which you can sell.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, it's also a scenario of understanding which products actually have expired. That's why you also need to do a stock take notice,
mm-hmm.
which have expired. And in some cases, I will probably have to interrogate it, but how do the shops actually, prevent waste? In commercial terms, it's known as wastage. How do they prevent waste? Specifically with products.
Like in terms of disposal?
Disposing of expired products and the likes, because we're talking about chocolates. We're talking about those packets of chips that you find on the shelf. We're talking about fresh produce, fruits and vegetables. We're talking about chemicals from detergents to to all-purpose cleaning chemicals to what's the other thing also, to dairy products, to meat products. How do they dispose of things that the customer did not buy yet, but unfortunately had already
reached its expiration
period? So it's a huge financial burden on a business, because they continuously work on a value-based system, and the value-based system is between the shop and its customer, that the customer will always come back and buy at least 70% of everything in the shop. Not just to go buy your bread and your milk,
mm-hmm.
but so many other products that need to be bought.
Okay, my turn. Hold on. Just let me finish my story. As I was saying, my man, you've been finishing your story for 10 minutes now. Even my chassis is getting warm. Just give more eyes. Anyways, long story short. Oh, hi. When you're talking, it's a short story long. Short stories turn long. Go best together with Tassenberg. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and you're still listening to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. In case you haven't noticed, human beings are not very different from wild animals, especially in relations to migration. So this migration in the coming together world in these urbanization structures, we now have to, we are facing problems. And one of those problems is housing, hence terms like informal settlement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, with that, the guys from the UN, and they have this program running from 2026 to 2029, their catalog of solutions to the housing problem. That's going to run from 2026 to 2029. I'm already seeing a number of problems with that, but we'll get to that. I'll just share my point of view on that later, but let's just look at one of the things. Now, on page 11 of that document, housing sector profile, I just decided to go straight to previous applications. UN Habitat has conducted a housing sector profile in Latin America, Africa, Asia since 2010, providing a foundation for understanding housing system and informing policy and program development key examples. Then they looked at, you know, Egypt in 2017, Ghana in 2011, and, you know, AFCON's, you know, AFCON, everyone's favorite AFCON country, Cabo Verde, and the Comrades. Still reading it, dude.
Well, you're the one that mentioned everyone's favorite AFCON country.
Yeah.
I was like, who?
Oh,
Cabo Verde. Cape Verde.
Yeah. Yeah, now you have Cabo Verde, and then other countries they looked at, Guinea-Bissau, Ivory Coast, Lesotho, El Salvador, Ghana. And now Ghana was also, you know, the Ghana's stats were updated in 2024. And Nepal, Liberia, Afghanistan, Myanmar, Guyana, Iraq, Bahrain. And I was like, Iraq? Housing is Iraq's least of the problems.
That's surprising. But you know what, Helmut? Good examples are literally what we as Namibia need.
Like, all we just need, if you ask me, is alternative, affordable building materials that will lead to affordable housing. Because, I think the discussion of housing is, you know, we're approaching that that discussion in the same way that we approach the discussion on food.
Yeah.
It's not the food that is not available. The food is there. It's the means to access the food.
Mm.
There are a lot of houses. The problem is these houses are not within the affordable range of most people.
No, it's not.
Especially in Namibia.
No, it's not, Hamad. And if you looked at the generations,
yeah.
if you really looked at the generations, now my parents were baby boomers. Let me be honest. Their parents were part of the lost generation that they call it. But there was a system that helped the people between 1930 or 1920 probably, or 1930 basically,
mm-hmm.
up to like 1970. Now that was for two generations. After that, now you will hear mostly from the Americans and from the British, they would talk of a perspective from what they've seen in their societies. But then when you go do a little bit of interrogation in Namibia, you get to the same conclusion that they've also got reached, Helmut.
Yeah.
Now, there was a whole bunch of about two or three documentaries I watched back in last month in April about the differences in terms of achieving wealth between the generations. The baby boomers were born between 1945 or between 1940 and 1959. The baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
They had access to affordable land. They had access. They were trained very early. Okay, in a Namibian context, obviously, when apartheid was down rampant and became rampant in the 50s and 60s. Case, yeah. There was a reliance on the vocational skills, the actual vocational skills.
Yeah.
That reliance, and you were just given basic education. So up until standard 8 back then was literally like grade 10. So in many cases, you were allowed to exit school whenever. But mandatory school going was also not a situation, because literally what you probably also discovered when you looked at your uncles and your dad, them, they were like told it's either you go to school or you don't eat, or you come and look after the cattle at home. And we ensure survivability of the family.
Yeah.
Now that was also a scenario that I discovered with another lady, who is, you know, she's a domestic worker here in Windhoek. She also explained it to me and my sister specifically, about how, you know, she got into this line of business of this job, because we have to look at the generational impacts that have happened. The baby boomers had access to land pretty quickly. My uncle, even the other day, he's 77, 76. My uncle told me when literally became 16, he could buy a car.
At 16?
At 16.
Ha!
At 16, Helmut. There was no requirement to also finish grade 12. Now, it's literally the police is on your case if you don't finish grade 12.
Well, technically also, Grade 12 technically doesn't exist anymore because MESAC or its previous iteration as a ministry, Ministry of Education, Arts and Culture, literally went and spoiled that indication primarily where, to my understanding and to what a template of a, of an addition of a, what,
additional
what is grade? AS? What is AS again? Advanced subsidiary level.
Yeah.
The advanced subsidiary level in high school or in secondary education is supposed to be a 13th year. It's a year between the 12th year of education and university. Do you want to add more skill sets in your development and to be able to be ready to be absorbed into the university? Yeah. Because a friend of mine told me that her brother literally could get exempted when before NUST became Polytechnic. He could get exempted for much of the first year subjects because he took the AS, the A level. They call it the A levels at St. Paul's. He took the A levels at St. Paul's and he got exempted from much of the IT subjects in the first year at Polytechnic. He got exempted from high school, directly from high school into tertiary institution. Now, if you go and ask now that similar particular template and situation currently happening in our public school system, you'll find chaos. Because nothing is clear. Cambridge was clear.
Oh, yeah.
The last Cambridge iterations with that young, was my younger brother, which was literally 2009 or 2010. And then came this new system of this
NSSC,
which is supposedly equivalent to the Cambridge system. But if you go and read about the Cambridge system internationally, it is actually a higher standard. So Namibia technically went and decided to water down already a standard that tries to benchmark everything for you for a developing country because we wanted to say we wanted to develop our own thing. So yeah, but I'm digressing once again because I'm fixated on the education component. At the heart of what the baby boomers experienced, yes, they didn't have access to a lot of opportunities. But no, they yes, they didn't have much rights. Let me correct that. They didn't have much rights, but it was easy for them to get jobs. Because the earnings they could get from the jobs was allowed them to be able to afford the particular, which is now considered luxuries in 2026. For example, a house is now a luxury, an economic luxury.
Hamoud,
a house, not a unit in an estate, not, not a flat in a complex, a house, freestanding house with an erf. Is a luxury.
That's
now
on your name.
That's on your name or the title deed on your name. It's a luxury right today in 2026. It's a luxury. The second scenario was also they realized that they could be content with the one job that they started on as a 19-year-old. They could marry in by the age of 20 or 21. They could have their five kids by the age of 30. And then they could just work for themselves from the age of 40. Do you remember that video that I sent you about the Industrialized Revolution?
Yeah.
The lady that technically was speaking about the AI trends.
Yeah. Comparing it to the Industrial Revolution.
What did she highlight from what is the, some of the data that is coming through from most millennials and Gen Zs right now? Millennials, which is where you and I are. She says, first, the average first homeowner in 2026, the average age is at 40-year-old.
Yep.
Whereas for the baby boomers, the average age was literally in the 20s. The people could buy property early on.
You could buy a house, not be able to afford to rent one. Just buy one.
You just
around 29.
Yeah. Just like that. They just bought a house. So this particular indication, Helmut, should show economic planners, like for example in Namibia's particular perspective, interventions like that are sought. They are sought. And for example, City of Windhoek to now, you know, have like a late afterthought of, oh, let's introduce, was it 8 new suburbs? Oh, wow. Do you know the budget that you've got to apply with that app, with that establishment of 8 new suburbs? Do you know the budget that you need? Yes, the problem, they obviously, they do need to know the budget. But Helmut, it's a bit late. It's the same question like the question that I had about the Sovereign Wealth Fund when it came into effect in 2023.
2023, was, is it a bit too late to now be talking about a sovereign wealth fund? Shouldn't we have had a sovereign wealth fund literally in the 90s already, when we became independent?
Well, judging by how much money we have stolen, I think we have implemented, we would have implemented
that.
Point of question, judging by the amount of money they have stolen.
Who's they, Helmut?
No.
Who's they?
I don't want to mention any names.
Okay,
I don't have a lawyer.
Okay. I just also need to know that because...
You know, look, if you look at, all the corruption scandals that have happened in Namibia, and you look at Mozambique and Kenya now with a lawyer who was, representing clients during the day, and then she was orchestrating her own criminal activities in the middle of the night.
We also won't mention any names.
We won't mention any names, even that all these things are public knowledge. If you didn't know this,
that's our disclaimer. As long as don't mention the names.
Anyway, here's the thing. This whole keeps taking us to one thing. We are not very good at solving problems. We are good. I feel like we enjoy talking about the symptoms.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look at housing, for example. The discussion of housing, it's a very interesting one. And that's because it more often starts with land.
Yeah.
You have to acquire virgin land, and you have to service that land. And then by the time that you start talking about setting up a structure, you must have a whole lot of money.
Yep. I mean, Helmut, let me give you an example. Worst property, if you go to Rehoboth.
Yeah.
The worst property. Literally, I'm saying the worst property in the town limits. Then the person is seeking 300,000.
That's the worst.
And then there is not even services connected by the town council as yet, because the person just acquired the plot, the erf, and it just stood there. It just stood there vacant. 500,000, Helmut. In some cases it's a bargain, some cases not. But the concern stemming from what I'm highlighting there is today, you can see pure profiteering taking place. Now, remember when I asked you the question, what does Namibia really want to be? Do we really want to be a capitalist society with rampant greed running unchallenged, unabated, undetected? Or do we really want to be a socialist society? We are thinking for the society.
Mm-hmm.
We are taking the society's needs at heart, and we first try to solve the society's particular demands and needs and wants. Because the way our local authorities are going about by trying to, I don't know, because they're not producing land. Let's be honest. So the first thing I can't understand is, why are they selling land in the first place if they're going to make perpetual income from the services? Helmut, I would read sometimes the city of Windhoek statements that we got, and they were charging me for people who show up twice in the 12-month period to sweep the street. And then on the day that they even sweep, I don't even see them sweeping there. But I get charged. I get charged. I'm like, what is this? Why is this right here? No one even challenged it.
Well, the streets are clean.
Helmut.
Mm-hmm.
Helmut. 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 You get charged every month for something that happens twice in the year.
Yeah.
Every month you get
charged.
Is that
the only thing the money is allocated to, though?
They indicated there is a billable item.
Really?
They indicated there's a billable item. A billable item being billed every month. I actually encourage every listener who's a property owner in Windhoek, go and look at your rates, electricity and water bill.
Mm-hmm.
Go and look at what they charge you guys for someone sweeping your street twice in a year, or even like back in last year, there was no presence of such a person. There was no presence. But you still get charged the thing.
You get charged, obviously, for the refuse removal. You get charged, obviously, when the lines in your street get repainted. You get charged for if the guy with that that comes and trims the bushes there opposite your properties, you know, the bush that's part of the public domain. You get charged for that. You didn't ask them to come and cut, you know, the bushes and the grass after the rains. You get charged for that.
Well, they're going to have to make the money to pay the guy somehow.
That's not your land. You can't be charged for something that's not your land.
So it's their land. They must be paying.
Yes, but you get charged for that.
But now, how do they make the money? Because we know they don't have a business to sell a product or offer a service or some sort.
They make perpetual income.
From?
From everything else.
Apart from charging you for the guy that's trimming the bush that's right next to your fence.
Imagine how many actual property owners are in Windhoek.
Ooh, boy.
So now you charge every person, let's say $30 Namibian for sweeping the street from the old parts of Karatura, let's say from Koreanghap, heading this way to Windhoek East. You charge every property owner who receives... a statement.
Yeah.
That $30 Namibian a month. So let's say residential properties are at least, let's make it at around 50,000. 50,000 times 30, how much? Per month. Every month.
Not every year.
Every month, because you have to must make that $30 per month. Every month. And it's literally one person or two people that come and sweep. Ne? So if I say it's 30 times 50,000, because I'm thumbsucking the 50,000, it's 1.5 million that they just make. Straight like that. You don't see this person. You don't have proof that this person swept the streets. You don't own the street even, because the title deed speaks to what, Helmut? Your four corners that you own. That's what your title deed speaks to.
Yeah.
The title deed does not speak to the road that leads to the four corners of your property, because you're not in charge of that road. But you get charged for something that's there, out there, outside your property. So, when I made the statement of local authorities in the modern developmental agenda really need to rethink their strategy around making land available, affordable housing. We've not exhausted affordable housing through alternative building materials.
No.
Because I still believe...
I think last time I checked, we're not even seriously exploring that.
Because I seriously believe we can actually achieve greater housing adoption if literally from Ministry of Urban and Rural Development all the way down to all the local authorities change their bylaws specifically on construction materials.
Okay. Now you have seen the Egyptian embassy, right?
Which is two streets.
Yeah.
In Kenneth Kaunda.
This side of is it in the same? It's not in the same street.
No, it's not Kenneth Kaunda. It's Berg Street.
What's that?
Berg. Not Berg, not the Afrikaans word Berg, which is also Berg.
Just Berg.
Berg, the German one for town.
Oh.
B-U-R-G is town.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, now, I didn't know that. Now, the thing is, if you just get into, you know, if you just get into, that's the city you just mentioned.
Mm.
The entrance side of the Egyptian embassy, you'll find this security guard house on the outside.
Mm.
Yeah. That material is one that I think would make excellent alternative building material.
Helmut, you don't have to go far.
And like the list of alternative materials.
Okay. What material is it first? Because I've seen the security, thing that they've got, but I don't look at it because it's so big and it's so obvious.
It's predominantly aluminium for the most part. Most of the used material, you can just say this is just aluminium, but you know, it's it's made in a ways that first of all, it's going to last. That's because, I mean, it's aluminium. It doesn't rust like iron.
Mm.
Yeah, because the more you know, the fresh piece of aluminium is exposed to oxygen, it forms a non-corrosive layer, which is why aluminium doesn't rust as easy as iron does. But you know, that material now, anyone also that has been to Hakahana Clinic knows about this. There's this newly extended part. I mean, when I say newly, I'm talking about 3-4 years ago that it was added on. Mm. First of all, you have this Hakahana Community Hall, and you have Hakahana Clinic, and on the other side you have this newly, I think this was a Project Hope also, or something. Yeah. That's the very same material that they use, and they build a very nice structure that, when you look at it, you can't be interested in the housing discussion and look at that structure and not think about how awesome that alternative material would be in terms of solving housing problems. Things, I don't know why we are obsessed with, and I think, for a very long time, I did not know why, I didn't understand our obsession with brick and mortar until you pointed out the financing.
It's the banks.
Yeah.
Firstly, it's the banks. Secondly, it's,
the legislation.
The strict, local authority legislation.
In terms of what material should be used.
Yeah, which is where I stumbled upon the archaic indications of measurement.
Yeah, the one with inches.
Inches, pounds per square foot. I was like, what?
Pounds per square my foot.
I mean, seriously. Who's still allowed for this? But yeah, every year, every 5 years, we vote for politicians who don't answer these needs. Because they still don't answer.
Look, I think the most, important part to discuss is the financing part.
What the banks allow.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do this, Amun. Let me explain to you a scenario. You obviously highlighted now, what's the thing's name that, a desired building material from that security house at the Egyptian embassy.
Yeah.
Let me highlight to you the next thing, for example. So I went to just inquire about a container 2 weeks back from one of the, there's a business here that sells containers in Windhoek. They literally have it on site as well. And
like a shipment container?
Yeah, shipping container. And I asked them, you know, do they know anybody that does, just out of curiosity, because I've been exploring the subject matter that in future, if, when I'm, you know, gonna have my own place, I would like to buy the plot, the erf, and then buy the containers. I want to make myself.
Oh, I've seen a bunch of videos on that, like the guys that are very creative at the, you know, turning one fancy house out of that.
Yeah. And make myself a container house, because I don't want to deal with construction workers and contractors and issues of architects and planners and wat so goed and wat so. I'm not interested in that stuff. You just want to get to have your place. That's all you want.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I was jokingly also throwing that idea to my sister, and she was like, "It's still considered a tin shack." Well, it's in its way, technically, you know, it has to have a look and feel to it.
Look, it's better than being homeless. It's
very true, but it's actually a tin shack that can actually outlive a brick and mortar house.
Yeah.
So I stood there talking to the consultant selling the containers, and he said they themselves submitted a proposal to the city of Windhoek under the affordable housing agenda. And obviously, when I asked him what happened, he highlighted they just never got any response back from the local authority. But it's not the first time that such innovative housing solutions,
uh-huh,
were put forward,
uh-huh,
to the public sector. But yet the public sector wants the private sector to act. But yet the public sector
does not want
just
to
goes
listen.
Deaf. They just go deaf on actual solutions. Helmut, when, like,
so housing is not our problem.
Housing is not our problem.
It's not our problem, is it?
It's not our problem. It's dealing with town councils, municipal councils,
the local authorities are the issues. And there was also another particular article I read the other day about how apparently the private banking sector is a problem for business innovation in Namibia, which is not true, actually.
Okay, a problem like in what way?
When you go and ask for a loan as a startup, as a newly founded company or business, you go ask for a loan, you can't provide the collateral. And when, you know, when the serious business hits the fan, obviously those that borrowed you money will come calling first.
Yeah.
It is your job to make sure you built up your strength, your position of strength, so that you can pay those people back. Because you did borrow money. You don't want them employing or deploying lawyers on you, which will add more onto the costs of what you will have to repay them.
Yep.
However, that is a little bit of a different nuanced picture versus what should be straightforward for Namibia's development agenda, Helmut. It should be straightforward. If the government wants to save money, the government just has to look, the government, which is the Ministry of Urban and Rural Development, and its subservient town councils, municipal councils, and village councils.
Yeah.
It just has to look at innovative building materials and methods to allow for a housing demand to be met. I don't want a house made out of hemp, please. I don't want people just accidentally
smoking my house. I know.
Yeah, but and then the whole community is eating.
All of a sudden, you have guys
with the munchies everywhere,
heads that look like a mop. But the thing is, we have a commercial break coming.
Hold on, just let me finish my story. As I was saying, my man, you've been finishing your story for 10 minutes now. Even my chassis is getting warm. Just give more eyes. Anyways, long story short. When you're talking, it's a short story long. Short stories turn long. Go best together with Tassenberg. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. 14 minutes left to the hour of 6. It turns out, as in everything, again, we have been, we have just been thinking we have a problem. No, we don't.
We have a pandemic.
Plus, we can think, so we're not dumb. There are a lot of options in terms of building material we just don't want to explore. That's for a lot of other reasons, I can imagine, over why we are just choosing to leave people homeless. Because one of the biggest problems, especially in Namibia when it comes to housing, is one of every year you read a story about a family that suffered a house fire, especially in coastal towns, because you cannot use the materials that's used anywhere else, like here in Windhoek, where you can use zinc. You can't use those. You can't use that material in coastal places because they're going to rust faster than you can blink because of the salty moisture. So they use wooden materials in most of their what you describe as shanty towns. Now, while wooden materials are exactly that, wood, which catches fire very often. So unless we enjoy watching people suffering from house fires, you know, which more often burns down entire blocks.
Yeah.
I don't understand why we are not looking into the direction of alternative building material, especially when you begin to look at the fact that come to the realization that there are a lot of private entities that are interested in helping with alternative building materials.
Mm.
We just decided, you know what? It wasn't written in laws that we adopted after apartheid. Therefore, that's why we can't use it. Like, really? At this point, are you even interested in solving the problem? So someone who literally operates a business of building materials, alternative building materials, in this case, shipping containers, gave, shared that idea with the public sector. You have a private sector which shared that idea with the public sector, and they never got back to them.
Mm.
And that's the very same public sector that keeps running around saying, you know what, we have a housing problem. We don't have a housing problem. We have an alternative building material adoption problem.
Yeah. Because if you go and look at the market that exists, the market that supplies materials to build a home, to build a house, to build a property, that market obviously wants to protect its market share.
So
you have to go and buy cement. You have to go and buy bricks. You have to go do this and you have to go do that. Yet we have government policy that wants us to innovate, but you are limited and you are boxed in by, for example, local authority legislation, which doesn't make things cheaper.
So we have innovation in theory, but in practice you have a lot of, red tapes.
It is a lot of red tape. I'll be honest to just acknowledge it is a lot of red tape, Helmut, because we are being told, because I'm not part of the TZUF situation. Yeah, I must be low 45. We are now being asked innovate, but you're not allowing the innovation to happen in the existing markets like property and land. You're not allowing it.
Okay, so we already have an established, market which has a lot of economic, which does provides a lot of contribution to the overall economy.
Yeah,
and that's the one with the brick and mortar as a primary building material for the housing discussion. So that means now lawmakers are caught in between a rock and hard place in terms of trying to solve the housing problem, and also on one side they do not want to disturb the already existing brick and mortar established material or supply which has a lot of money invested in it. So in other words, we don't want to disturb our, the foundation of the money that we are getting. So, and we love this money so much. We don't find the over expansion of shanty towns a problem.
Yeah. We don't.
We are basically sacrificing the community.
We don't.
So that you can keep, call it an... Look, the contribution to the economy is a very relevant one. But now it goes to show the priority of where your priorities lie, basically, as a public official.
Mm.
Yeah, because do you want to house people or do you want to... maintain some kind of economic, status, but that itself will just, come up, that it in itself will just open up a new, economic window, right?
Mm-hmm. It will, Helmut, because look at China's economic property, economic boom in its property market, because, much of that development was based upon providing as much upmarket, middle income market, and even lower income market property, solutions to a varying degree of Chinese citizens in that particular economic sense. But when you come to anywhere else in the world, no one was focusing on actually trying to flush in as much property developments into the economy as much as possible so that there is an absorption rate. Helmut, for much of these properties in Windhoek that potentially cost from $1 million Namibian dollars and upwards, you will find an equivalent of the same property in Cape Town, in Johannesburg, in Pretoria, for 300,000 to 500,000 Namibian dollars in value. you'll find, and I'm not talking about one or two, you'll find 10 in a neighborhood, 7 in a neighborhood over there, 20 in a neighborhood over there. You will find adequate access to the property and even the financing associated to it. Because the South Africans back then decided to oversupply. Windhoek is boxed in, Helmut. Windhoek has an issue. Windhoek has to spend money again, potentially, in future, to buy more land, because I told you, Mus, there's a farm.
Oh, yeah.
There are farms literally bordering
right on. We're surrounded by farms, yeah.
We're literally bordering right on to Windhoek. We will have, the city of Windhoek will have to buy farms again. And again. And again. And again. And again. Now, if people are worried about affordability, about the financial position of, like, a local authority, you have to start there with supply. The supply of one of the main commodities in the modern economy. Property, land, and services. How do you meet these particular demands? And guess what? Services are more than 50,000 Namibian dollars in Windhoek. To connect the property with water and electricity.
Yeah.
And sewage connections.
Removal, yeah.
It's more than 50,000 Namibian dollars. Now, out of your pocket.
Ask yourself one question. How many people earn enough to afford to service land at, you know, at that cost? And then you'll answer a question of, how many people, how fast are you going to be at solving the housing problem?
Well, super slow.
7 billion years over 70 years? I still remember that one.
A billion for the next 70 years?
A billion dollars a year.
For the next 70 years.
And that's assuming, and you know, the funny thing is when we were talking about that, we kept saying that that's assuming that you know, there is no
inflation,
which is, it's constantly taking place.
We are assuming that the 300,000 backlog stays at the same 300,000.
Yeah, and also there is not going to be any event that will disturb global economy. Donald Trump was like, we will
be. That was 2 years ago that way.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then, Donald Trump's foreign policy happened.
Yeah.
So that means at this point, we are not even talking about 70 years. Make it 100. We don't have a food problem. We have a means to access the food problem. We don't have
a land problem. No. We have
a means to access
land. We don't have a building materials problem. We literally have a lot of red tape, which boxes you in from what you can afford.
Innovate, but don't do this. How do you think innovation is done? By doing exactly what you're telling me not to do.
Do you know what they're doing in Berlin, Hamid? They, to meet their affordable housing needs in Berlin, which the city of Windhoek has a twin city agreement with. It's the only African country, the only African city, supposedly, I say supposedly, that has a twinning agreement with Berlin.
That's an identical twin, right?
Twinning is like you share insights on developments and new ideas in inverted commas, in quotation marks. But
that's like me sharing twin academic ideas with, who is this, who's our former foreign relations minister?
Mushilenga.
Yeah. How is that going to go?
With someone who is as super qualified as him.
Yeah, he has more degrees than Namibia's years of independence. And now... Okay, my life read. Right. It runs in the family, guys. This is the genes. It's a very cool guy, though. I know, right? Welwitschia University 2026 July applications are now open. Faculty of Health Sciences, Postgraduate Diploma in Community Health Nursing Level 8. Admission requirements. Have a recognized nursing qualification. Sorry, guys. No, no, that's when my jokes is now getting to me. Right. Yeah. Vilvicha University 2026 July applications are now open. Faculty of Health Sciences, a postgraduate diploma in community health nursing, level 8. Admission requirements: have a recognized nursing qualification at NQF level 7 or higher from any recognized higher learning institutions. Must have a registered nurse slash midwife with the Nursing Council of Namibia, HPCNA. Must have a minimum of 2 years working experience as a nurse slash midwife in any health facility. Must write a short essay describing the motivation of pursuing postgraduate diploma in community health nursing. Qualification duration, 1 year. Mode of delivery, full-time. For more information, please call 081-403-6406. Vilvicha University, where everyone is an achiever. Twin City, Berlin and Windhoek. That's a nice one. So just a couple of seconds left to the hour of six. Then we are talking about that will bring us to the end. Basically, this brings us to the end of Home Run for today. But the building material alternative is one that I think voters should start asking our representatives about. Have we tried exploring some other alternative? Just do your own, just play around on the internet about available, building materials. Because if we really want to solve the housing market, my point of view is we have to start exploring alternative forms of building materials. And it, from the look of things, we already have a lot of them. It's just red tapes that are standing in the way. So there are a lot of, innovative. We are constantly telling people to go out there and start a business, be innovative. If someone comes up with a new building material, chances are very high they're just going to be shut down by all those red tapes because we don't want to disrupt an already existing market of building material that's based solely on brick and mortar.
And here's also...
That's painful.
The aspect in terms of looking at, working towards the sort of like solving a housing issue. Now, this solutions report, which is technically not a report, it's like a fully recommendation report by the UN Habitat. They speak here of how you've got to work with sustainable mobility, because it's not just about saying, okay, allow Dwight to go build whatever he wants to build, wherever he finds a piece of property, let's say in the Comas region. Yeah. But it's also looking at taking a 360-degree approach towards where this person will set up their own place, their own dwelling and the likes. Yeah. So we're talking about things like sustainable mobility that they're talking about here, urban mobility, sorry. Energy and resource efficient buildings. So if it's going to be mass housing or affordable housing like flat buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's also, I'm trying to look for that one thing specifically about affordable, alternative building materials as well, because I saw it here somewhere. But durable solutions, yeah, but that's like solutions for displaced people, meaning refugees and the likes. And also potentially looking at the overall national strategy, because a national strategy shouldn't take 70 years with 70 billion into perpetuity, and we still assume we're dealing with the 300,000 housing backlog.
That's not going to happen.
Which is not going to happen. By the time we reach year 70...
Look, every sunset, people are busy. You can't just count on on the... It's not always going to be 300,000 is the point I'm making, but go on.
Look. That sentence just defeated my presentation. But okay, yeah. David is here. We'll have to call it quits just for now. Obviously, let's see each other again. Same time, same place tomorrow, guys. Well, we'll obviously try to have a more serious face and persona.
Look, I can only try, but look.
As long as my colleague, my co-host, permits.
You know what? look, this, you know, look, this problem of housing,
yeah,
and the lack of exploration in alternative ways of solving the problem,
yeah,
just because you have you don't want to disrupt an existing market, is the reason why you have a lot of people in the quote unquote developed countries living in their cars. It's not due to lack of housing.
Oh, yeah, that was an American and an Australian problem.
Yeah, the people,
the UK problem.
Their entire communities that are living in their cars, not because they want to live in their cars.
But it's because there's nothing there.
There's nothing. They can't just afford the houses that are available. It's not there. It's not that the houses are not there. The houses are there. But to sustain the economic model that the house are built on, people are being rendered what?
Homeless.
Homeless. And this is being done, you know, at least policy-wise, by people that are, you know, running around with a, you know, with a book that starts with a, that opens with, we the people, we had to represent the people. The people are homeless. But, well, David is here. Until tomorrow, is it tomorrow or more?
More.
Okay. More.
Tot more too.
Tot more. Is it toch or too?
Tot. Toch is some, is like a plea. It's
okay.
Like to say please. Tot more too.
Tot more too.
This has been the home run, guys. Minus Helmut's intermissions.
I know.
But yeah, stay tuned. We'll be back after this with the business and economics segment.
Yeah.